Japanization of American corporate governance, evidence of the never-ending history for corporate law. And if you look at the literature over the past 5 years, you'll notice something very interesting in the convergence debate. Indeed, I would challenge anyone in this room to go on Lexis or to go on Westlaw and to pull up articles on comparative corporate governance and to find an article that does not mention the convergence debate. Indeed, I think this would be a very long and arduous task, because inevitably these days, almost every piece on comparative corporate governance mentions the convergence debate. And not only is the debate mentioned, but increasingly over the last 5 years, you'll see papers specifically on this narrow point of convergence. 50, 60, 70-page papers on this narrow issue. And the debate has become very sophisticated, which has made the papers longer and longer to read. But there is an interesting thing about this debate, and it is a common assumption. And that is what my paper challenges. Now, what is this assumption? Well, convergence is all about whether other systems, global systems of corporate governance, are going to come to one specific model. And that model, especially over the last 5 to 10 years, has been assumed to be the American model. And the American model has been assumed to have two features: shareholder primacy and dispersed shareholding. Now, again, I mentioned how the debate has become very sophisticated. And indeed, there are many, many different points of view. But you can generally divide the debate into two camps: the American evolutionists and the path-dependent theorists. Now, what do the American evolutionists say? Well, they say there is this American model defined by dispersed shareholding and shareholder primacy, and that America reached this model first. That it is the most efficient system in the world, and because it is the most efficient, all other countries around the world will be forced to either adopt this model or perish. And then you have the other theorists, the path-dependent theorists. And there are many, many different and sophisticated points of view on path dependence. But, to generalize, the path dependent theorists, they all talk about constraints. They assume that there is this one model, dispersed shareholding and shareholder primacy. But they say that all countries in the world will not reach this endpoint. They say the American evolutionists are wrong. This endpoint is not going to be reached. Why won't it be reached? Because there's these historical constraints. Now, the constraints have been made up of culture, they've been made up of law, they've been made up of many, many things. But they all say that something is going to hold other countries back from adopting this American model. But hopefully, from the brief explanation that I've given already, it's apparent that even though there are path-dependent theorists and American evolutionists, they both agree on what this fixed endpoint model is: dispersed shareholding and shareholder primacy. What my paper does is it provides an argument that this point is false, that this point does not exist, that while everybody is arguing whether or not this point will be reached, this point is moot. It's over here. So everybody is arguing, are we going to reach this point? Are we not going to reach this point? They're writing 60, 70 pages on if this point will be reached or not. At the end of the day, this endpoint is not there anymore. And so I challenge the debate, and in fact, in my paper I use very somewhat strong language. I say that the debate is fundamentally flawed and it is not worth fixing. So So I don't want to rain on the parade today because everybody's talking about convergence and I'm saying throw out the debate. Anyways, I will clarify that point a bit, but that is my general conclusion. Now, everybody in the room is probably wondering, I'm saying there's this assumption. Of course, my argument doesn't work unless there is this assumption. So let's look at the literature and let's see if the assumption has been made. Hansman and Krackman, their article has been mentioned many times today. The end of history for corporate law. Let's look what they say. The triumph of the shareholder-oriented model of the corporation over its principal competitors is now assured. Indeed, they say most of corporate law has already converged on the American model. Well, they're not considering that the American model is changing. That's the last thing that is entering into their mind. They're saying that everybody else is going to adopt the model. So it doesn't come into their mind that it's changing. Let's take the Gang of Four, which Professor Cox mentioned. Rowe, another leader in the field. Coffee, who's been mentioned several times today. They all disagree with one another. They all say that each one is wrong, and they will go into great detail about that. But they all have one thing in common. Generally, they talk about dispersed shareholding, and they explain why all other systems in the world, minus the UK and the United States, why they haven't adopted dispersed shareholding. Now, they disagree, but you cut underneath their argument and what you see. You see the commonality, that they see dispersed shareholding as the endpoint. They see it as an optimal system. And if it's optimal, obviously it's static. It doesn't even pop into the argument that this could be abandoned. Bainbridge, 2002. He writes an excellent piece which identifies the assumption. He goes through maybe 10 or 12 different articles and convincingly argues that the debate, the convergence debate, assumes that the U.S. model to which global systems are or are not converging is one of shareholder primacy. Now, I must admit, I started writing this paper, and I hadn't read Bainbridge's paper. I read the first two paragraphs, and I thought, I'm going to throw my paper in the garbage. He's already written my paper. Then I read through his paper, and I come to see that he says, no, it's not the shareholder primacy model. Everybody's got it wrong, it's a director primacy model. But then, his paper assumes that this director primacy model is what should be exported. He presents another static, fixed, endpoint model. Professor Gilson, and his article has been mentioned several times today. Formal versus functional convergence. It's a very interesting theory. It has a lot of value. But let's read what it says. If you read it, he says that formal change only occurs as a last resort. And if you go to his primary first piece, he says that the bank systems, the bank-based corporate governance systems, have reached a state of last resort. But then he goes on to give reasons why American corporate governance has been extremely resilient in its form. Again, the picture is of a static model, shareholder primacy, dispersed shareholding. Now, I'll come closer to home, the Japanese legal scholars. You'll find many, many articles, and indeed I cite one or two in my piece. These articles go on for 50 pages. They talk about the American model, as if everybody understands what the American model is. Of course, it's obvious. Shareholder primacy, dispersed shareholding. There's no explanation of any possible development. It's just assumed that it is known. The Japanese legal reforms, and this takes it from the theoretical to the practical. The Japanese reforms are often billed as implementing the American model. Again, several times these reforms are pitched in the abstract, just the American model is mentioned. Because it is assumed to be known. It is static. It is fixed. Indeed, this has worked its way into the practical again. IMF and World Bank, 1997, Asian financial crisis. If you go through the specific measures that they tied to changes to their funding, of course, the IMF and the World Bank, they don't just write checks and hand them out. When they write their checks and hand them out, as Professor Kim will no doubt attest to, they put in many conditions. And if you read through the conditions, the assumption is that they want to implement this American model. Well, what am I here to tell you? I'm here to tell you exactly the opposite. The American model has not been static. It has greatly evolved. And it is a story of evolution that I paint in my paper. That since the late 1980s, the American model has consistently changed. Now, how do I get to this point? What evidence do I present? Well, I show throughout my paper that the American model has developed several un-American features. Features that are completely opposite of what the American model is assumed to be. So at the end of the day, where does this leave us? Well, the irony is, again, while everybody is considering whether China, Japan, Korea, or other countries are wondering whether the American model is going to be adopted in their own homeland, the American model does not exist in America. And that is the point of my paper. Now let's get into the substance. Banks. I say that banks are now beginning to play a major role in American corporate governance. 2001, Professor Gilson article. This is not Gilson's point of view. I should be very clear and I should put the quote in context. This is how Gilson is describing the literature at the time. He said that American corporate governance, a large number of comparatively small banks that for practical purposes play no role in corporate governance. An accurate description of the literature. Indeed. Indeed, if you read the comparative corporate governance literature, you'll see that the American model is often defined by the absence of banks, that it is a market monitoring model. The evolution. What evidence do I present to show that this assumption is wrong? Two prominent American scholars, Baird and Rasmussen, 2006, University of Pennsylvania, law journal article. I think this is, in terms of shedding light on this issue of groundbreaking peace. Now, they're not worried about the convergence debate. They don't mention it in their piece. They're simply talking about American corporate governance. What do they say? What conclusions do they come to? They conclude three things. The principal mechanism for replacing inefficient management in underperforming firms? Banks. Banks are the most important mechanism for monitoring companies throughout their entire life cycle. Importantly, not just in the bankruptcy stage. Their final conclusion, even more interesting. They say that banks are significantly more important as a governance mechanism than hostile takeovers. And I would say to everybody in the room to read this piece. This is a very important piece. Now, this is just one part of the puzzle, but I'm starting to put it together. Also, importantly, my paper shows that Baird and Rasmussen show that there has been an evolution. That this wasn't the situation 30 years ago. They point to legal changes, they point to changes in corporate culture, they point to economic reasons why banks have emerged as a greater force in American corporate governance. Dispersed shareholding. Now, as I mentioned to you before, this is one of the pillars. The American model is based on dispersed shareholding. Again, I don't have to explain. The Gang of Four, Coffey, Roe. All of their arguments are based on this assumption that the UK, but it's prominently coming from the American perspective, that the United States is a dispersed shareholding system. Again, let's look at the facts. 1970, you had 70% of American stocks were owned by individuals. 1994, 48%. Where did those shares go? Well, those shares went from institutional, or went from individuals to large institutional investors. We see the statistics for large institutional investors, 30% to 50%. So you have a concentration. You don't have further dispersion. You've had an evolution towards more concentration. 1998, there were 255 publicly traded U.S. companies with dual class stock, controlling structures. If you look even more recently, Google, DreamWorks, these are seen as cutting edge, leading edge American firms, have went forward with controlling structures. They went public, I mean, with controlling structures. Now, Gilson, again, a recently released article, Harvard Law Review 2006, he provides a very nice touch to this point. And what he does is he shows empirically that a controlling shareholder system can be as efficient, or a concentrated system as well, can be as efficient as a dispersed system. He goes to Sweden for this evidence. Interesting piece, though, because you won't find another piece like it since the burst of the bubble. When Japan in the late 80s was at its peak, nobody would blink an eye at this Gilson piece. He presents it as something new. I would say it is something retro. He went back to what they were writing about in the late 1980s. Hostile takeovers. Let's look at the assumption. Coates. Coates says that hostile takeovers are the mechanism that transforms the limited de jure shareholder voice into a powerful de facto form of shareholder control. Coffee. Coffee says the market for corporate control is the ultimate disciplinary mechanism. He uses very colorful language. He says that hostile takeovers are the final guillotine in the corporate governance structure. Professor Gilson, 2001. What does Gilson say? Well, Gilson says the commonly held view of the American model is that it is catalyzed by hostile takeovers. Obviously, hostile takeovers are seen as the method in the American model that makes it a shareholder primacy model. Now let's look at what I see as the evidence for evolution. I think Professor Bedchuk, in a number of pieces, has presented very convincing, very well-reported evidence that the combination of defense mechanisms, but especially defense mechanisms combined with the staggered board, has significantly insulated directors from the threat of hostile takeovers. And Bedchuk does it very in a sophisticated manner, and again, I would point you to that, to his pieces. But even on a more crass basis, if you just look at the numbers, we have 92 hostile bids, 1995 to 2000. 1985 to 1990, we have 1,032. Now, of course, we need to talk about why this difference has occurred, what the difference in the bids are, and this is not a sophisticated measure as Bedchuk measures, but I think it makes the point clear. We have significant change. Baird and Rasmussen, at the end of the day, what do they conclude? As I mentioned before, they said board members rarely worry about the distant threat of hostile takeovers anymore, but pay attention when the businesses' banks come calling. This is not a shareholder primacy model anymore. This is a model that has evolved, where banks play a role. So at the end of the day, where does this get us to? And in my paper, what point do I arrive at? Well, it is that the American model, which is painted in the convergence literature, and let me be clear on that, because it is not all American corporate scholars. As I say in my paper, corporate law scholars in the U.S. haven't been sitting around twiddling their thumbs for the last 20 years saying that everything has stayed the same. Indeed, specialists in each of these fields have identified these changes. But in the convergence debate, it has been assumed that there is this stagnant model. But that is not the case. In the 1980s, indeed, maybe the model was based on hostile takeovers and shareholder primacy. But in the 1990s, there was a movement towards insulating the directors, allowing them to build upon those gains. And Professor Kaplan lays this out nicely in one of his pieces. So throughout this entire period, we have a process of constant evolution and adaptation, not stagnation, like the convergence debate assumes. Now, this is the interesting twist, and unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time to get into the details of this, but from a person that focuses on Japanese corporate governance, this is maybe the most interesting part. And I was very shocked when I compared the results of the evolution in the United States against what the traditional Japanese model is. Now, as I mentioned, what has evolved in the United States? Or what has evolved in American corporate governance? Bank monitoring. An inefficient hostile takeover regime. Concentrated shareholding. Well, what does this sound like? This sounds like the typical Japanese main bank model. So, what does this lead us to? It leads us to a very strange question. And indeed, I know Professor Abbey, when he first saw my title, I think he thought it was a typographical error. Because I put the Japanization of American corporate governance. Everybody these days is writing about Americanization, not just in corporate law, but in the wider context. Everybody talks about things being Americanized. Here I am saying things are being Japanized. It's Japanization of American corporate governance. But I think if you look at the features that have developed, you can't help if you have on your narrow convergence glasses in the way the debate has been framed to ask this question. But maybe surprisingly for some of you, in my paper I quickly disperse with this question and I say no. We're not witnessing a Japanization. And the reason why, well, you can quickly point to lifetime employment is something that's not developing in the United States, which played a central role in the Japanese model. But I think more importantly, and in the theme of my paper, the more important reason why we're not witnessing a Japanization is because the Japanese model also no longer exists. People talk about the Japanese model, but the Japanese model has changed. Now, it's interesting, though, to look at how the Japanese model has changed. And the reason why it is interesting is because if you look at the change, there was not much change during the lost decade, the period from the early 90s to 2001. Despite a raft of legal reforms, despite huge economic pressure, most of the people who have taken a serious look at what has happened in Japan, the model stayed fairly stagnant. Now, where did the change come? And I go into this in another paper that I've written. But the change came in the Japanese economy. I think one of the most important changes in corporate governance hasn't come through an Americanization, hasn't come through hostile takeovers, hasn't come through independent directors, but it's come from a change that occurred to the main bank system itself, the no-fail bank policy. And I explain to my people why this is important. Because if you look at the perverse lending of main banks in the lost decade, which I've written an entire paper on, this was put forward, or this was caused by the fact that there was this no-fail bank policy. But the interesting point, and this is where my criticism comes in, you miss this if you have on your narrow convergence glasses, if you're looking through this lens. Everybody's trying to see if there's Americanization, looking at hostile takeovers, independent directors. Because that's the argument. But what's going on here with the change? Nobody examines inside the Japanese model how it has changed. So that brings me to my conclusion. I say that the debate is fundamentally flawed and it is not worth fixing. I'll admit it's a very bold conclusion. When we've made a seminar or a conference on the convergence debate to say that. But I put an important qualification. The qualification is that convergence can be a very useful and important debate if it is framed properly. And it is this improper framing of the assumption that there is one fixed endpoint model that exists, that is more, the most efficient model, that has made the debate irrelevant. And so I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not saying that the entire issue of whether specific regulations are becoming similar, or whether audit committees or other aspects, that's fine. Or whether even the system in the United States of hostile takeovers is useful to take the 1989 system and to try to use that mechanism to help in transitional economies. But what I am saying is the way that the debate has been framed by the leaders in the field has made it an irrelevant debate. And why? Well, what is the point? If there's a fixed endpoint model, if you have this endpoint, it makes sense to measure how far systems have moved along towards this endpoint. Makes perfect sense. You track how long they've moved. If systems are moving around, models are changing all of the time, whether they are closer or farther apart at any given point in time, it doesn't matter because they could come close, they could go back, they could go forward, so it tells us very little. But I think, of course, that is the theoretical debate. The practical point of this is if you're looking at exporting the American model, you have to say to yourself, if it is changing as I show that it has, and if you export a dispersed shareholding and shareholder primacy model, even assuming perfect implementation, even if you assume that the tree is perfectly transplanted, you're going to get a very different result. So even assuming perfect transplantation, and usually it's this transplantation issue that is important. But by the time the tree, to use Professor Kinsley, by the time the tree has started to grow, the tree in America has changed. So it's turning the debate on its head. And it has important practical implications because if you look as I mentioned, the IMF and the World Bank, they have gone on this assumption. Other countries, as Professor Kim has said, in Korea, there's resistance to this. And perhaps one of the arguments should be, this isn't even happening in the United States. Why should we be adopting it? So my suggestion, and I make this in my paper for future research, is not to focus on these broadly ill-defined static models. It is to focus on something else, adaptation. What has allowed certain mechanisms to become prominent at different times in American corporate governance? What allowed, in a high growth era in Japan, the proper mechanisms to develop? Now, of course, policymakers won't like this conclusion. It's not easy to package adaptation. I don't even suggest a way to measure it in my paper. This is a point for further research. But I don't think we should kid ourselves and pretend like there is a solution, an easy package solution, when it doesn't exist. Maybe my conclusion is unreasonable. Maybe it is unreasonable to package an export adaptation. But let's just admit what we are doing then. And that is the point that I arrive at in my paper. And one little caveat for all the writers in the room is, I think the idea that systems are constantly evolving is also good for academics. Because if things are always changing, we will always have something new to write about.